for part two of our three-part look and listen at Galactic Rock with Gasoline McCormick.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
You gotta think, too, late 60s, too. Wanted to mention Jimi Hendrix.
Yes.
Right? He has a couple of songs that kind of drift out there into the outer galaxies. We think of Third Stone from the Sun, which is an instrumental, but it's based on Third Stone from the Sun, I think, refers to Earth kind of thing, yep. Right? So that's kind of some sort of galaxy kind of thing, right? He's got one called, I think, Highway Child is another kind of space theme one. There's one called Astro Man. So, you know, Hendrix was looking into the interstellar galaxies for some inspiration there, too. I think that a lot of that might have had to do with some of the psychedelic drugs people were taking.
A little bit.
Their minds into some sort of different galaxies and ways of thinking, right? And where can you go besides Earth? You got to go outwards. Let's go out into the outer space and see what we can explore there, right?
Yeah, you had a good catch on your list as well. While we're talking about late 60s, early 70s, you had 2,000 Light Years from Home by the Stones.
Yeah, that's a great one too. 2,000 Light Years from Home is about someone drifting out of the galaxy, and they're just getting further and further away from home base, right? So you can interpret that as being literal or kind of existential, kind of thing like that. But you listen to the music too, and the music is very psychedelic and trippy, and it lends itself to that kind of outer space vibe too. Turning around. Another one we didn't mention too, we're talking late 60s, is probably my favorite sci-fi galactic rock song. When you mentioned this list, Troy, two or three songs came to me right away. And the first one was by Creedence Clearwater Revival with It Came Out of the Sky, which is a burning kind of rockabilly song about this kind of farm boy who's out there in the pasture, and he's looking up into the sky, and he kind of spots a UFO in the sky, right? So He kind of tells the story. He goes back into town and he tells this story about this UFO that he saw. And he becomes kind of a famous celebrity because he saw a UFO, right? So it's great. And it's a burning rock song, too. So, yeah, that's a really cool one.
Yeah, that's from Willie and the Poor Boys from 69, right?
Yeah. They released three records in 1969, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and they're all fucking great, right?
Yeah, it's nuts. What is Effigy on? Is it
self? Yeah,
that's
on Willie and the Poor Boys too. That's on the same record, yeah.
Yeah, somehow, like, I don't own Willie and the Poor Boys. I have a few others, but I don't have that. But Effigy blows me away.
Yeah.
Again, not related to what we're talking about, but thanks for sharing that one, because that was not on my radar, which I guess is kind of an appropriate phrase for our show. So I guess, when did you got Contact by Leonard Nimoy?
Once we had contact, reception was clear. Preparing to lock into orbit. Polarization, a magnetic storm. Our systems couldn't absorb it. Take a step closer. A light year has passed. All instrumentation reads go. Visual contact firmly established. Strength of the signal will grow. Make one more effort. Channels are open. The past is a thing of the past. Communicate now. Before the collision, make a decision. Separation is closing fast. Closing fast. Closing fast. Closing fast. Request permission to land.
Put a 3 or 4 records out there, late 60s, early 70s, which I love. You know, I remember getting this import CD. I remember mid 90s, there was this CD store on Yonge Street, and it was just south of HMV, and they only sold imports, right? It was like you go upstairs and it's this little shop, and they only sold import CDs. So I found a lot of great things there. And one CD I found was this Leonard Nimoy compilation on CD called Highly Illogical. And it had about 20 songs from his 5 or 6 records there that he made early 70s, late 60s. And one of the tracks on there was Contact, which is classic, right? So it's very atmospheric, and it's about kind of this guy is in this kind of spaceship, and he's trying to make contact with the mothership to land, but he's having problems doing this, right? But it's very like spacey kind of music, and you have the great voice of Leonard Nimoy. He's not really singing this one. He's kind of talking this story on top of this music, which is fantastic. So I love that. Yeah, that's a cool one.
Yeah, we played a little bit of his Bilbo Baggins a number of episodes back. I'm not even sure where how it came up, but we did play a little clip of Leonard.
He's great. And just as an aside, he has a song called Spock Thoughts, which is I guess that's kind of related because it's about Spock, which is a sci-fi character. And this song is like my mantra. I think this song is brilliant. If you're ever feeling kind of down or you're unsure about where your life is going, like put this song on and it'll make you feel better in 3 minutes. He's just kind of talking about how the universe evolves and how you're part of the universe and everything happens for a reason and the good and bad and the yin and yang of love and life and love and all that stuff. It's beautiful. So Leonard Nimoy is fabulous. Yeah. Spock Thoughts. Good stuff.
You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive him to be, and whatever your labors and aspirations, in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with your soul. With all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be careful. Strive to be happy.
I guess we need to move on to David Bowie, who is sort of like pretty much Mr. Sci-Fi in terms of music. And not only in terms of music, when David and I were talking about the show the other day, we were realizing that a really big chunk of his acting body of work is in genre. So he really has affected sci-fi, both in terms of his music and his work on the big screen. So let's go back to 1969. We get his response to the film Space Odyssey with Space Oddity. And it's,
well, I never put them together. I'm just putting that together. Wow, I never put that together until now. Troy, that's awesome.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control.
Away from that for a bit, but in big time in 1972, it comes back to science fiction with the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. And then, like, he keeps coming back. He keeps coming back to the sci-fi concepts. In 1980, he comes back to Ashes to Ashes. Also, I guess, even in his Berlin period, there are spacey things. Isn't there a song about like his love for his television or something? I'm trying to think of what it's called. Oh my, anyway, we'll cut that out clearly. And probably put it in the blooper reel. And then up into his final album too. I was just listening to Black Star before the show, and that qualifies for sure, at least if we're going to assume that the visuals from the video, which involve a dead astronaut, count for anything. Any thoughts on the Thin White Duke guys?
Obviously, Ziggy Stardust is a great record, classic, right? Mick Ronson, yeah. Starman, those songs.
Yeah, and I mean, no one is really ever fully responsible for a movement, but really kind of like the figurehead of glam rock. We had T-Rex happening prior to, but it felt like Bowie became the face of glam. Mm.
Him and Elton John, like both of them were so standout and had great concerts, and was almost like, you know, it almost brought in the era of these larger kind of stadium rock kind of shows where the presentation is just so almost as important as the music.
Yeah. Well, you know, that first generation of rock and roll, how it freaked people out. It freaked out politicians, preachers, and parents. Well, my parents who loved Elvis, you know, they were okay with early rock and roll. But when I was a kid and the big three threats were like Cooper, Alice Cooper, Bowie, and Kiss. Those were the new versions of like Chuck Berry, Elvis, and Little Richard. You know, these are the guys who like would freak out parents. It's like, no, just don't, you can't listen to that. Your life will be ruined. And that's a great thing. Like rock should always have balls and should always be a bit of a threat to the establishment. So it was kind of cool having those around. And I remember this point where I had a babysitter in the early 70s and she had Alice Cooper written across her jean jacket in black marker, right? And it caused such a debate in my family, like, do we have to get rid of her? Do we need to get a new babysitter? She's got Alice Cooper written on the back of her jacket. Like, this, what, God knows, she might be doing drugs or killing children in the sink. Who knows what's going on? So yeah, it's great when rock has that sort of that threat to it.
It was the start of kind of the shock rock genre too, right? You know, shocking people with their appearance and their music and their vibes and their themes and stuff like that. And I think a lot of the androgynous nature of people like David Bowie and Alice Cooper, they also brought some girls into the scene, right? That normally wouldn't be into these kind of hard rock bands, but they were brought into liking Alice Cooper and David Bowie because of that.
Yeah, and it's, now this is off the top of my head. There might be things that I'm missing, but it feels to me like in popular culture, that was the first expression of alternative sexuality in a big way. You know, it wasn't something that was hidden, or you had to go to a special store to buy this stuff. It's like, no, here are these bands and they have a look and they're sort of espousing it, at least implicitly if not explicitly, various forms of sexuality, you know.
Well, I mean, it was there if you wanted to see it. It's just what people saw, right? Like Little Richard, if you look at Little Richard in the 50s.
True enough.
Right, he puts it right there, right on the front page kind of thing, right? But just people didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And they turn a blind eye to Little Richard kind of thing.
Right. And certainly even true of Liberace, not rock.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
You know, it's like, it's pretty clear what's going on here.
With Alice Cooper also, I did just one of the moments I loved of him. I know it's not sort of genre, even though it had Mike Myers, but in Wayne's World, there they are backstage pass with Alice Cooper, and Alice Cooper talks about the history of Milwaukee and his band, and it's just one of the great moments in that film.
We're not mental or anything, so don't be afraid. My name is Wayne, and this is Garth.
Nice to meet you guys.
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
Well, I'm a regular visitor here, but Milwaukee has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name?
Yes, Pete, it is. Actually, it's pronounced Miliwake, which is Algonquin for the good land.
I was not aware of that.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of Milwaukee is the fact that it's the only major American city to have ever elected three socialist mayors.
Does this guy know how to party or what?
Huh? Huh?
That's Milwaukee. A good,
yeah, Milwaukee.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, too, because he's a guy who, like, I've always liked his stuff. Like, there's stuff all through the career where you go, no, that's still good. Like, he's still happening. This is still right. And I guess it was Clones in 1980. Feels right.
Yeah, Clones is around 80, 81. He had there was a 4-year period there, 80 to 83, where he put out 4 records and it's kind of called the lost years. Those 4 records. Yeah. He was doing like drugs and he was on alcohol and he basically doesn't remember this 3 or 4 year period, but he puts out 4 records, well, what's the first one? Special Forces. That's got a song called Space Pirates on it, which is kind of a sci-fi song.
Yeah.
And I think, and then Flush the Fashion, and then Zipper Catches Skin. And then the fourth of the Lost era is Dada, which is my favorite, which is fabulous. That's actually that's the title track. Dada is very horror-esque, scary. Check that one out. But there's a lot of great creepy things and weird things on those four records from that period.
You know what, Lee? You just reminded me that, what year would Dada have come out? Like 82 or something?
Like 83, probably 83, 84.
Okay. I remember reading like a positive review of it in Rolling Stone and sort of like making a mental note, like, I have to check that out. So 40 years later, I may get around to checking that out. That single came out, I was like, I just remember how into it I was, and I just thought it was really cool that that Coop was able to make that slight adjustment in sound, you know. And it sounded very contemporary,
new wave sounding, and cool creepy video too. He looks like a monster in that video.
Yeah And so there's a guy who has a library that probably every third song would be considered genre.
Absolutely.
So along with this is just a few that I really like that have stood out over the years. Clones, Feed My Frankenstein, which I think is the song that is played in the Wayne's World film, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yep. Yeah, and Ballad of Dwight Fry from the Love It to Death album from 71.
The cool thing about Ballad of Dwight Fry too is that he's writing a song about like Renfrew. Right, like the guy, the assistant to the monster, the assistant to the master. And here's write a song about this little guy that doesn't get the spotlight shown on him. But let's write a song about the troubles of this guy and the craziness in his mind kind of thing, which I think is so great, you know?
Yeah, and another little genre connection for Coop, not musical, but he's in John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, which is, I think, a really underrated film and one that I really like. I watched it for the first time and I don't know, maybe since I saw it in the theater last year, and it's still got a really cool vibe to it. And Coop really pulls it off. He plays like a homeless guy who is like sort of heading up all of the homeless people in this city. And they're basically becoming unwilling agents of Satan.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Alice is the coolest, man. You got to mention too the theme from what was the Friday the 13th? I forget which one.
Oh,
it was.
Oh yeah. That's right. The Man Behind the Mask or something.
From 86. Yeah. That's a great one too. You listen to the original version from the Constrictor album, and it's very 80s sounding. It's all processed. It's a drum machine and keyboards. But he plays it live these days with his like full on rock band rock guitars, and it sounds really heavy. So. Really cool song. And even when he plays it live these days, he'll bring out like a guy dressed up like Jason with a machete to battle Alice during that song, right?
Yeah. Well, here's a guy who basically invented the stage show, right? With the guillotine on stage.
Yeah, bringing snakes and all that stuff, horror, dead babies, you know?
Yeah. Lee, do you want to talk to sort of the contribution of Kiss, because I mean, they're right up there certainly with like, you know, in my mind with Bowie and Cooper and Kiss in terms of rock and roll and its sort of genre connections.
Sure. Well, the one thing people always say about Kiss is they're like comic book superheroes come to life that play rock and roll kind of thing, right? Based on characters and the themes of each character has got a different vibe, right? We mentioned Gene Simmons is kind of the horror guy and Ace Frehley is the spaceman. He's the space ace, right? He's from Jendel and he landed on Earth and he hooked up with these other three guys and they started Kiss, right? So he's not used to the gravity on Earth. So that's why he kind of wobbles on stage and that's why he kind of has a hard time adjusting to gravity on Earth kind of thing, right? And they got a lot of great songs about, sci-fi. Not an Ace Frehley song specifically, but 100,000 Years off the first Kiss record, which was written by Paul Stanley. That song is about like time travel through outer space and trying to get back to, and this guy who's time traveling through the universe and he's meeting up with this girl, right, who's been waiting for him for 100,000 years to return kind of thing. But like every kind of Ace Frehley song, or not every song, but, you know, a lot of the Ace Frehley songs have that kind of sci-fi character theme to them. Rocket Ride is a great one, right, about this girl that wants to take a ride on a rocket. That could be a rocket spaceship, or it could be a euphemism for something else. She wants to take a ride on something else kind of thing, right? So
yeah, I saw that on your list, and I gave it a listen because I hadn't heard it in years, and yeah, it's a good tune.
Yeah, Lady Space, man. Take a ride. She wants a rocket, take a ride on the rock kind of thing, right? There's a good one called Into the Void, which Kiss did when they did their in quotation reunion album in 98. They had featured a song by Ace there. And interesting thing about this was it wasn't really a sci-fi themed song, but Gene Simmons said, "Oh, you gotta change the lyrics to be sci-fi because you're the space ace." So it's kind of that thing he's kind of pigeonholed into writing these songs about space. So they changed the lyrics so they're all about black holes and kind of thing. So that's another kind of euphemism.
If he's, I was going to say
in outer space, or another kind of black hole that he's trying to get into kind of thing, right?
Oh no.
So for wow. both of you guys, tell me your first experiences of that you remember of seeing or hearing Kiss.
Well, my first experience was, I can remember like it was yesterday. I was 5 years old and visiting my grandparents, my nan's house, and my uncle Paul was 6 or 7 years older than me. And I would always go through his record collection. And I was 5 years old going through these records, looking at the covers, and all of a sudden I saw the cover for the first Kiss album, that black cover, similar to the Meet the Beatles cover, where it's all black and you just see their four faces there, right? But it was the Kiss faces with that makeup, and I was just looking at that cover and I was like, what is this? It was just crazy looking, right? And I remember dropping the needle on that record, and the music just spoke to me as well. So I became an instant fan, and just right in there with the whole theme of the characters and the music matched the personas, and not revealing their true identities and that whole thing, I just thought was amazing. And the mix with the comic book and the sci-fi and everything was so great. And so yeah, that made me a fan at a very young age.
What about you, David?
Well, my friend Marcus, who is the big Kiss fan, sort of brought me into the whole Kiss army kind of thing, because he would listen to it. And there was so many tie-ins with Kiss. I mean, it was incredible because you had the comics. They were on various shows, sometimes, playing themselves kind of thing. And they obviously had very good branding and had very good presence and really got themselves out there. So, you could probably have Kiss on Sesame Street, for example, or whatever, like whatever it was. There was just so much of them and their presence that it was almost hard to, you'd have to purposefully try to ignore them, which you couldn't. So yeah, they were basically there, and they had, of course, the great shows and so on. So yeah, for sure. And some of those songs still, you can still hear them, like some of them are still ones that you can hear even at a ball game or at a hockey game or whatever it is, the organist starts running into this thing and say, "Oh my God, they're starting to play some Kiss."
Yeah,
like they're not going to last without songs, right? You got to have good songs. Like the gimmick's going to take you so far, but you got to have good music to last 50 years, which they've done.
Well, you wanted the best.
The Kissing Superman of the Park film, that's a classic, right? A classic B-movie, superhero, sci-fi kind of film that they did, TV movie there in 78.
Yeah, I was a big Howard the Duck fan, and I think I've got a Howard the Duck Kiss crossover, or one where they like just appear
it's like from the 70s, I think.
Yeah, right? yeah, like mid 70s. Yeah, like.
Do you guys know? This is weird, and I don't know if you guys are aware of the Utopia band, the Todd Rundgren's Utopia, because I had a number of their albums and just loved their music. But one of them talks about Born on a World he didn't make or whatever. All these lines sounded exactly like the comic Howard the Duck. It was almost like that they had taken that and ran with it.
Right. And it's funny, now that we're doing a little Howard the Duck riff, I've been really back into the Pretenders this week. And I realized there's a song, I forget which one it is, but she references Howard the Duck. It's probably from the first album. It's either the first or the second album. But it's just, you catch it. It's the first line of every verse. It's like something about Howard the Duck. And you have to go back to it and find that one.
Yeah, the song, in case you want to reference it later, I don't know if that's Troy or Roth. But it's called Trapped in a World You Didn't Make. Even though I like a lot of the other stuff from Utopia, you know, he did an album, Oops, Wrong Planet.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah,
that sounds good. So we've done Kook, we've done Kiss. We'll have to go back in a sec to, I guess let's do Rush now. It's Rush is almost like the quintessential sci-fi band. As soon as Neil Peart joins the band, there's no more songs about girls, you know, for better or worse, or being working men or whatever. It's all of a sudden sci-fi palooza from the Rush camp. And I'm okay with that. I still love 2112. And I remember, actually, speaking of uncles lending us musically, my uncle had 2112 on 8-track. And I had bought tickets to see them at the Gardens, but I think maybe I didn't own anything yet, or maybe I only owned the new release, which was, oh Jesus, not Permanent Waves, the next one, Moving Pictures. The overture to 2112, just love it.
Thank you.
also on that album is a song called Twilight Zone, and I'm a huge Twilight Zone fan. So, and I know I get where you're coming from about Neil Peart and drumming. Lee, for those who don't know, is an excellent drummer. You have so many styles down, man. Like it impresses the hell out of me. I get some of your previous comments on Neil and Neil Peart, and you can sort of reinforce them here if you like. But yeah. What would you say about Rush in general?
Oh, I mean, I love Rush.
Yeah,
one of my favorite bands. I just bought a 6-pack of Rush beer a couple hours ago. Actually, you know,
nice
with the 2112 Starman logo on the can, which is awesome. Yeah, Neil Peart is not one of my favorite drummers, but he is an incredible drummer. Right. And every once in a while, I will get in the mood to listen to that, right? But I'm more of a like a Charlie Watts, Ringo Starr, Al Jackson Jr. kind of pocket, easy, you know, simple, kind of laid back grooves kind of thing. But Neil Peart is an incredible musician, and he's perfect for that band.
Yeah,
right. So, 2112, that the side one of that record is incredible. The way it starts, it just starts with outer space galactic sounds, right? And the band kicks in. It's incredible. And the story, the story would work as a film kind of thing, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm surprised that has not been actually developed yet. It's been a while since I've thought about it. Is music banned in the world of 2112, and then the kid comes across a guitar in a cave or something? Is that the deal?
Something like that, yeah. He finds a guitar, he learns how to play it, and then he goes in front of the council, and they try to suppress him. They try to, like, say, no, you can't have that kind of thing, and then he realizes that's how he's going to take over the world, is with his guitar. Something like that. I forget, I haven't revisited it in a while, but it's something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Taking over the world with a guitar is something that every kid, at least every boy who I think has picked one up, can relate to.
The ending of that that side where it the kind of story concludes, and it's the guy comes on the speaker and he's like, we have assumed control, we have assumed control, and that, like, that's how it ends.
Yeah.
yeah
And you know, then we had Hemispheres, we had A Farewell to Kings.
Yeah, Hemispheres with Cygnus X1 Book One and Book Two, and all that stuff, right?
And that's the thing. I've since first hearing them, I've always loved Rush, and for a lot of reasons, I have a dislike for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and their whole process. But like trying to blackball Rush and keep them out was ridiculous. It took, you know, basically the fan base and a grassroots movement to finally get them past Jan Wenner.
Introduction by Dave Grohl, like that was the one where he went up on stage and said, "Hey, I'm bringing them into the hall." Like his whole speech about growing up on Rush and what they meant and so on. It was just brilliant.
Yeah. Although that does remind me of the issue of male camel toe in the spread of, what is that? Is that 20? No, that's what album has that really awful spread in the inside of the gatefold, and they look like they're wearing Star Wars.
Back cover of 2112 when they're in their like robes and
their
pants and everything like that. Yeah,
yeah, they look like Jedi and Alex. Yeah, has those far too tight pants on. So let's move on to George Clinton and his band's Parliament Funkadelic, also known as the Collective P-Funk. Lots of great stuff there that is super funky and sci-fi related. Now on our show, Lee, last year we had a guest, Maya Wentz, and when we were looking for sci-fi related music, she gave us the Mothership Connection, and she blew my mind. It's like, yes, somebody's like bringing up the P-Funk. So people need to check out the cover of this album. Google it. The Mothership Connection from 1975 has this great picture of George Clinton appearing like feet first with these massive platform boots coming out of this UFO. And he's kind of like pantless, I think. And the whole concept is just great, of just this sort of outer space funk band. And it was followed up in 1976 by the clones of Dr. Funkenstein.
Good evening. Do not attempt to adjust your radio. There is nothing wrong. We have taken control as to bring you this special show. We will return it to you as soon as you are grooving. Welcome to station WEFUNK, better known as We Funk. Or deeper still, the Mothership Connection, home of the extraterrestrial brothers, dealers of funky music, P-Funk, Uncut Funk, The Bomb.
Coming to you directly from the Mothership, top of the chocolate Milky Way, 500,000 kilowatts of P-Funk power. So kick back, dig, while we do it to you in your eardrums. Oh, me, I'm known as Lollipop Man, alias the long-haired sucker. My motto is...
Make mine the P-Funk. I want my funk uncut. Yeah, make my funk the P-Funk. I want to get funked up.
I want the P-Funk.
Yeah.
Make mine the
P-Funk. Yeah, W-E-F-U-N-K, y'all. Now, this is what I want y'all to do. If you got faults, defects, or shortcomings, you know, like arthritis, rheumatism, or migraines, whatever part of your body it is, I want you to lay it on your radio. Let the vibes flow through. Funk not only moves, it can remove. Dig? The desired effect is what you get when you improve your interplanetary functionship. Sir Lollipop Man, chocolate-coated freaking habit form. Doing it to you in 3D. So groovy that I dig me. Once upon a time called now. Somebody say, is there funk after death? I say, it's 7 up. Yeah. P-funk. Uncut funk.
Everything about P-Funk, I mean, is to me is the epitome of funk post James Brown. Anyway, do you have anything to share about these guys?
Yeah, great live too, incredible live show, and they would actually have a spaceship on stage that would land, and the band would come out of the spaceship kind of thing. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I saw them in, well, P-Funk, because just again, to clear up for people, there were two bands, Parliament and Funkadelic. Parliament was the more R&B based band, and Funkadelic was sort of like a Jimi Hendrix acid rock type of thing. But in later years, they've sort of combined to be just known as P-Funk when they do shows. And so this would have been around 1988. I saw them at the concert hall. And everybody I know who goes, oh, I was at that show, will tell you that it was in their top three shows ever, no matter who they've seen. And that was true of me as well. And I think the show went at least 3 hours long. And I swear to God, they only stopped playing three times. You know, like songs just morphed into the next thing, and there'd be a little jamming, just this funky shit going on. And, you know, I don't, other than Bootsy, you know, and Bernie Worrell was in it, but Eddie Hazel, who was an incredible guitarist, he left us, I think, in 92 or something. The band is just impeccable. And yeah, like the guitarist at the time was wearing a diaper and nothing else, like this massive oversized diaper. And just, it was an incredible show. Yeah. Well, if you get the chance, I don't know if George Clinton is still doing shows or not, but it's always a good time.
He's got to be like 80 now, George Clinton, bro.
Yeah. Considering he was doing like doo-wop stuff in the 1950s.
His Tales from the Tour Bus is a good episode.
Yeah, it's very good. Oh, actually, I will now mention something that I saw. I rewatched those episodes today, and he tells a story from the early days of Funkadelic, where they were traveling by car, and this is in the era of a lot of acid being dropped, and they had just gotten into acid, and they were lost trying to get to the next gig out in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. And so they're going along this dark country road, and all of a sudden up ahead they see, like, you know, 20 or 30 zombies walking around. And they think they're just having a really bad trip, but they're all seeing the zombies. And then they realize that this is actually the set of George Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
So they, like, sort of, like, get pushed on, like, hey, keep driving, please, you're in the shot, go away. But that must have been quite an experience.
Holy nightmare.
A few people from the early 70s maybe that we missed there, but Joe Cocker had a song called Space Captain, which is really cool. If you're familiar with that song, that's a really great song, Space Captain. Aerosmith had a song called Spaced, which is kind of a sci-fi thing. And one of those songs, I think, where you can kind of interpret it as being, you know, spaced outer space or spaced in your head kind of thing.
Right. Can go either way.
Yeah. Steve Miller. Steve Miller has a song called Space Cowboy.
Oh, yeah. How can I forget that one?
Before the kind of the Joker take the money and run era, when he was doing Living in the USA, that song Space Cowboy was pretty cool. It's got that I'm a space cowboy, and then that dun 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 dun, that lick, that's from that song.
And you had mentioned on your list, you had, like, one that I can't believe that I forgot to include, which is Space Truckin' by Deep Purple.
Oh yeah, classic, man.
Yeah. And some other really great, you know, heavy stuff from that era, like Sabbath, lots of Sabbath.
Sabbath has got a Supernaut, Into the Void. I love Planet Caravan by Sabbath is a cool one because it's very outer spacey and trippy. It's a good song if you want to smoke a joint, pretend you're floating around the galaxy. That's a very mellow kind of trippy song, Planet Caravan. Right.
Oh, I needed to back up for a second to Kiss again, because I had a note about how Ace Frehley on the how do you refer to those albums that were released, the four solo albums at the same time? Just the four solo albums?
Yeah, it was the Kiss solo albums.
Okay, all right.
One of the greatest moves in music history. Like, when has a band ever released four solo albums, like, on the same day, like, unified with the band logo in one corner? It was insane. It's so cool, man. It's one of the coolest things ever.
Yeah, it would have been tough at the time to be an act with a release at that time, because I remember you'd go into the record store and there would be the four albums, right? Yeah, taking up space. Usually, you know, previously it'd be like there'd be one Kiss album, you know, up on the rack or whatever, and then space for three other bands. But nope, Kiss now has taken over the whole store. But anyway, from Frehley's album, there's New York Groove. And the reason I'm mentioning that is, previously I'd been on Lee's show and we were talking about Stephen King and how Stephen King sort of interconnected with The Boss. So here's another Stephen King thing. In the Dark Tower series, the books, he references a scene in New York City where New York Groove is playing. It's either like a guy with a ghetto blaster or a car is going by as New York Groove is playing. And the thing is, this is a moment that repeats through time, where this guy is trying to avoid his death. But every time he hears New York Groove coming out of this car or whatever, he knows he's about to get killed. But it really got me into it. And so I was like, I've got to check out New York Groove. And it's like, I love it.
Many years since I was here, on the street, I was passing my time away. To the left and to the right, buildings towering to the sky, it's out of sight in the dead of night.
Yeah. sitting by my side saying, where are we? Stop the third and the 43, exit to the night, it's gonna be ecstasy. This place was meant for me. Ooh, I'm feeling so good tonight. Who cares about tomorrow? So baby, you better believe I'm not knocking in New York. I'm not knocking in New York.
Is that a cover song?
Please? Yeah, it's a cover by, is it Hello? Yeah, I think Hello was the band that did it. No, I always get the band that did the original version of I Love Rock and Roll and the band, the original version of New York Groove mixed up. One of them is Hello.
Yeah, and I've checked out the original one. I don't like it nearly as much as Ace's version.
Yeah, Ace is cool, man. His voice sounds great on that.
Yeah, and I also have for you, Lee, because I know you're a huge fan of Elvis, that I guess, starting in the late 60s, Elvis used to come on to stage to the theme from 2001, which is Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Strauss, but, you know, the famous 2001 theme.
Yeah, he started doing that in the early 70s, and that was just... You know, it's like one of the most epic ways to introduce someone, and Elvis is very deservedly, you know, Elvis deserves that kind of introduction.
Yeah,
you wait for the king to come on stage and the lights dim and you hear that. Oh my God, it's incredible, right?
Yeah, the anticipation.
Goosebumps, right?
And another note that I had that was specifically for you, really, again, being the Springsteen guy, my first exposure to Springsteen, I think, must have been the cover by Manfred Mann of Blinded by the Light. Because right. I don't think, I don't think I had had Bruce on my radar until, I'm guessing, The River. I'm guessing The River.
Were you Born to Run Misty? That was huge, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I grew up in a household that basically, in terms of the radio, all I could get was CFGM, the country station out of Richmond Hill. Right. My parents would not, they would let me listen to my records in my room, but quite a lot of the time, what I was getting was just off of top 10 radio. So Chum AM. So I don't recall hearing Bruce. Maybe the first thing might've been was Fire by the Pointer Sisters before the River album.
It was around then 79, 80.
That was on my radar. But my point is that Blinded by the Light, I loved it. Like the Manfred Mann version. Yeah. But you listen to that song and it sounds like they're doing this weird version of Won't Get Fooled Again or something with the synth that's on it. Right. And it struck me as being there's something science fiction-y going on here, just with the sound of the keyboards on it and the production. And even the fact that it's blinded by the light. I was thinking of things like Close Encounters. I was imagining there's this UFO and that's the light that's blinding you.
Madman drove his brothers and youths in the sun.
in the night, blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night, blinded by the light.
It was just really funny to then finally hear the original version and realizing it has none of those connotations, you know. What do you think of that cover?
Yeah, it's a great cover. I almost like it better than Springsteen's version, right? Like that was a number one song for Man for Man. You know, Springsteen has never had a number one song except for that, which he didn't perform. He wrote, but he didn't perform, right? And I was going to mention too, Troy, the interesting thing about we're talking about galactic rock sci-fi music is that with music, your own mind plays a big part of how you interpret the song, the music, the lyric kind of thing, right? So if you're a great songwriter, you're going to leave some room for interpretation to the listener, right? So just based on a title, based on a sound of a guitar, a keyboard sound, it might put that kind of sci-fi vibe in your head, and it may take you off on somewhere where you may think that Blinded by the Light is a sci-fi song, where really it's about a guy living on the streets in New Jersey in the early 70s kind of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And especially with some of those instrumental songs we talked about earlier, where it's just a title and a guitar lick or something like that that evokes some of these kind of galactic sounds. Right. There's a guitar tone or an effect called a phaser. You'll play a guitar and it kind of has that kind of sci-fi kind of warp to the signal of the sound, right, when you hit a note. So you know, that's kind of on that Blinded by the Light song. So that kind of can evoke some of these vibes to sci-fi vibes in music, right?
Come on back for part three of our three-part look and listen at galactic rock with guest Lee McCormick.